Captain Griffiths, Reel 5.
But he was, in fact, the SOE agent in Geneva. And
so a passport control is just his cover?
Oh, he didn't get... Yes, passport control was his cover. I was allowed to stay down in Geneva rather than go to not a prisoner of war holding up, but what they had interned crew at Vevey. And I was in Geneva the rest of August, September, until the end of October. Farrell managed this by saying that I needed treatment, and then that was that. So it was splendid living in the Hotel Bristol, and I went around with him a lot. We went round Switzerland, Zurich, and places, all with an idea in mind, and what was governing our thoughts. And I think Farrell's idea was that if Germany invaded Switzerland, he wanted to pick out and choose dropping zones in the hope that they could be used by the Swiss resistance, because undoubtedly there would be resistance. So I felt I wasn't wasting my time, and indeed there were other little jobs which I was able to do in Switzerland. And finally, I was able to get back to the UK. One should, of course, always try and get back to your unit if you can, but in this case, it is your duty to try and get back. The thing that was driving me was trying to get back to my wife and family in the UK. It's a very strong force in man to get back to your family. And it was arranged very well, but unfortunately it didn't come off. You see, this brings out what a wonderful thing it is to be living on an island. All information was in the UK. And I was briefed that I was to leave Switzerland. I had photographs which were in my lapels, the photographs of my crash, which came from Annecy. I had my car, my identity cards were... I was working for the Todd organization, and I lived in 8 Rue de Lac Annecy, that I'd had an accident and I was unfit for military service. That was pretty obvious. And then I had this work permit, which was that I was working for the Todd organization, buying and inspecting timber. These were beautiful papers to travel with. They actually gave me the straight briefing that I would be dropped over the frontier by a Swiss called Farquet. A 9-foot drop, as I subsequently discovered, which didn't do me any good. And I was to go to Annecy Annemasse Station, be about a 2-mile walk. And when I got to the station, I was to arrive holding my handkerchief in my left hand. And a man would put a ticket in my hand, and I was to go to where that ticket said. Now, looking at it this way, the man in Annecy was to buy the ticket and was to meet me, was told by London. London had already told Farrell and Geneva, what I was to do. Having arrived at this town, I was told, and I didn't know when I was told about this at first, where the town was. It would be on the ticket. It was Angoulême. And I was to go to the Café de la Paix and take a 20-franc note and put it on the table and order a drink. And in pencil, I should write on the corner, 4711, which was well-known type of perfume in France in those days. The waiter would take that, and I would then be taken to a safe house for the next Hudson or Lysander pickup. And this was the system. But you see, the clever part was, any part of that chain could be broken, but you couldn't get the whole of the chain. You still didn't know where the field was. You still didn't, and it is quite extraordinary how well it would have worked, I think, because this is how we move people about. Unfortunately, there was a panic that afternoon. We went to the frontier, and when I say we, there were two Belgians also with me, but they weren't going there. They were going on a lorry down to Perpignan in Spain, and as I now know. But we three were taken to the frontier by this man, Fouquet, and we went over between two poplar trees, and I hadn't realized it was such a heavy drop the other side. It was coming on dark, and I've got a funny back, which was hurting a parachute accident. Anyway, I dropped over, and the two Belgians came with me, Freddy and forget the other chap's name, and we set off. And we were immediately, well, very soon, stopped by a gendarme who wanted to see our papers. And he looked at mine, and he said, "You haven't signed that work permit." Everybody seemed to be in on it, you know. It's quite extraordinary. So I filled that in. And then on we went, and I went to the station, and I walked up and down that station for a long time. And furthermore, that Freddy and this other chap were supposed to go to a Gare au Savoir nearby, and they couldn't find it. And I should think I walked up and down for a good hour or so. And in the end, I said to these chaps, "Look, something's gone wrong. You can't make your contact, I can't, but I can get you back into Switzerland through the dog hole, the way I got in. It's about a 10-mile walk." So only one of us with me at the time, I turned around and I set off to walk back to the dog hole. And a man on a bicycle with a civilian raincoat came alongside me, and he looked at me and he said, "Are you looking for assistance?" or words to that effect. I said, "Have you got my ticket?" And he said, no, what ticket? He said, "You've been meeting somebody, you've come from Switzerland," and my accent was dreadful. And I said, yes. And I thought, well, now this chap must know. And as I now learn, and at this point, he was the policeman on duty outside the station, directing the traffic. He had seen me walking up and down with my left handkerchief in my left hand for about an hour, and he guessed that this was a chap trying to make contact. He was a member of some organization, a Mackey organization, but nevertheless, he got enough clues, and he said, "You better come with me. It's nearly curfew time." And we went, he pushed his bike, walked with myself and this chap, Freddy, and we went into his flat and up the stairs, and they opened the door, and believe me, I know, heart nearly stopped my mouth, it was full of gendarmes' uniforms. I didn't know he was a gendarme. On the push bike with a Macintosh, he looked like an ordinary Frenchman. In fact, he was a Corsican. But of course, he didn't know that I wasn't a true chap, that I... it was all very, very complex. But within, we spent that night in his flat, and next morning, what I call an old lady came to see me. We could only speak in French. Her name was Francoise. She was a school teacher. And she said to me, I'm going to, what is your squadron? And I wouldn't tell her, because the three things you must not tell. And this was a secret of a splendid thing. If you would not give them information about your squadron, that it meant you were fairly genuine. And she got very mad. And she said, well, I don't know, I'm not sure about you. I may come tomorrow. And off she went. And then she obviously must have had a contact with a pianist. And they got through to London, and they said that this man says his name is Griffiths, and he said, my middle name is Cromwell, and I'd use that quite a lot, because it helps if it's a well-known name. I mean, if you say you're Churchill and you're not, they don't shoot you right away. They keep you for a while, you know. And it does happen to be my name. Anyway, London got in touch with my wife Ruth, I think, I'm not sure, but they certainly said, this is what you must ask him. And next day she appeared, and it said, where did you spend your honeymoon? That's a honeymoon. And actually it was Swanage. I said, Swanage, all right. So obviously she'd been in touch with London and come back. There were other questions, but that was quite final. And the next thing was, the man with her, who was a great big brute, and obviously he was the executioner, if I hadn't been genuine, this is what worried me. He retired, and she said, I will take you on a line to see if we can get you into Spain. And we will go on the train at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon from Annamas station. She then gave me the briefing that I wasn't to admit that I knew her or even pretend, that I would be given a ticket, first class, that I would be taken round there and to the station and go in by the dustbins at the back of the restaurant. Incidentally, before all this happened, I must mention that Madame Roche, the Corsican's wife, and I'd been warned by my chaps I'd met up at the Vevey that one of the dangers when you stay with people in France, if you're British, is you're inclined to help with the washing up, or if the woman comes in the room carrying a load of logs, you go to help her. And then the husband, he's, say, got a job on during the day, and he gets a bit jealous. And he says, good God, here am I, leaving my wife behind with this chap. And he wonders what goes on. And having been told this, I suddenly realise that she was great fun, Madame Ross. She really was, absolutely innocent as anything. And I suddenly realised, just from this, before this happened, that old Roche was getting quite jealous. And so The answer is that you must be like a continental. And if you see a woman with two armfuls of logs coming in, you just lie back like a pig and don't do anything, you see. Don't make your bed, don't do the washing up while he's around. Oh, it was so funny that this should be going on, just as I'd been warned. And so there we are. Anyway, the next day we left, and she took me around to the station, and I went in by the dustbins. And then, strangely, I sat at a table, and a man in the most gorgeous uniform came and sat with me. His French was, of course, good. He spoke quite a bit of English. And of all things, he was the chief of the gendarmerie. And he explained that when the train came in, or rather, when it was time to go out the train, he would walk out alongside me, and I would then recognize which compartment the woman Françoise was in. And I merely go to get in and sit opposite her. There was a reserve seat, and this is how I finally got. So I'd gone into the station through the back door by the dustbins, then to get out on the station, when activity came for loading, I went out with this chief of the gendarmerie and was walked up to the first class carriage and got in. Meanwhile, there were, at this point, Germans on the door. I mean, Italy had packed it in, and they were in their usual efficient manner, checking everybody. And so getting on the train was quite dream. And then off we set. And eventually, after one or two checks, but we got through them all, the secret of the way that this woman, Françoise, got her men through was that she would cause a disturbance and so attract attention to herself with her genuine, she was genuinely French, schoolmistress from Toulouse. And when we got to Toulouse itself early in the morning, she had warned me that if ever there's trouble, I may collapse on the floor, in which case, I don't want to see you again. Off you go. And as we came out of giving up tickets and into the entrance hall, the doors were shut, and there were Germans and gendarmes there waiting, and obviously going to do a very good check. And she created hell when they wanted to open her bag. And this was the moment. There was a door into a sort of left luggage office. I went through that quickly. There was a man inside. He was obviously a cheminot of sorts. Never stopped me. I walked straight through. I walked out on the pavement, the far end, and I was away across very quietly and slowly, across the square, which is magnificent, opposite Toulouse station. And then I waited on the far side. And in time, this woman appeared, Françoise, helped by a gendarme at one side, another man on the other, carrying her bag, and she was put into a fiacre, F-I-A-C-R-E, one of these funny open landaus, horse-drawn, and they started off across the square, and I was most anxious because I'd lost my contact. But they turned down a street off the square, and I head after them, and she looked round, luckily, and she saw me and begged me to come on, and in the end I got on with her, and we drove in this fiacre out of the town. I should never forget it. The horse had spring halt, and he did annoy me, the driver, however. And then we came towards the outskirts of Toulouse, and told the driver to stop. We got out. I carried this wretched bag, which was very heavy, and she paid the driver, and he turned round and went back. And then we walked on. After a few yards, not many, we looked back. The driver turned round and he was off, had gone. So she turned round, and obviously this is part of her magnificent scheme, why she was never caught. She didn't go on, she turned round. She wanted to go well back. She hoped that if ever inquiries were made, the driver could say, oh yes, they went that way. Which of course was quite incorrect. So we went back to about beyond the point at which he dropped us. We'd already, might say, deceived him as to where we were going, and down an entry. And we went down this entry, and she said, there's an iron door. And when I point at the iron door, I'll be ahead of you. There's nobody else around. You wait outside, and I will go around, and in a few seconds or so, I'll pick you up. So I got to this iron door, and I stopped. And I thought, what do I do? Do I pull it? There's nothing to pull. There's nothing to knock. And I waited there. And then I heard rusty bolts being pulled, and the door opened, and there was a woman, quite tall, her eyes, very, very startling eyes, they were almost standing, you know. And she said to me, oh, sure, no, you'll be the man from Geneva, and you're about 3 hours late. And it was an Irish woman, and she ran one of these houses for our people going through. Her name was Therese Boudou de Rouville, and she was really quite extraordinary. She ran that house absolutely like any boarding school almost. The discipline was terrific. As soon as I was in, I was given some breakfast, and I was sitting at the table when a man came in the room, beret on his head, looked very swarthy, southern France, and actually he was an American, rear gunner. He had a Greek father called Manos and a Polish mother, and he'd bailed out a fortress over Paris on that attack on the 14th of July, 43. He was quite a character, was this fellow Joe. He was only 19, and he'd just about his third or fourth trip, he'd had to bail out with the aircraft on fire. And he landed in one of the parks in Paris, and he put his parachute under a seat, and then decided, as the raid was over, it was getting quiet, he'd see what was in this escape kit, which was very, our escape kits were good, maps and this, that and the other, currency. And he actually saw all this money, and the Americans used to carry 2,500 francs compared with our lousy 250. And he said, well, if I'm going to be a POW, I'm going to have a drink first. And he then walked out of the park to a bistro. Now, even in the wartime, people would still sit on the pavement outside and wait for somebody to come to them. But no, he walked straight inside to the serving hatch, where the normal people got there, where normal waiters went to. And he just slapped a 20-franc note down and said, give me a beer in English. The chap the other side said, are you English? He said, no, I'm American. And this serving chap the other side was one of our pianists. What a contact. So before you know where he was in Paris, and then he was moved out of Paris to help pick the great harvest, and then he was in this house at Toulouse, waiting to go on, ready for the mountains almost. And he was a bit difficult for Therese to handle. And she was quite a disciplinarian. Anyway, he soon came back in the room again. Oh, he'd spoken to me, and he said, "I hear you're a squadron leader." I said, "Yeah." He said, "What rank's that in R?" And I said, "Well, it's equivalent to a major." He said, gee, that's rank. I better go shift my things." Therese had told him to get out of his room because it was superior to the one that I was to occupy. And this was Joe. Well, there were times when he used to annoy Therese. He didn't mean to, but he'd turn the radio up on, listening to Tommy Dorsey or something, too loud. And she said, "For God's sake, the neighbours will hear it." And then again, I'd heard afterwards that the way she ran discipline and why it was so good was, I wasn't at the time, it was just before, the chaps used to go up and down the stairs on their toes without shoes on to keep quiet, but to get their limbs ready for climbing the mountains. And if somebody refused to do it, she'd say to them, "Do 10 press-ups, like that," and they'd laugh until lunchtime came. There was no food. And then by about 3 o'clock in the hour, they'd say, "When's the lunch coming, Therese?" And she said, "When Mr. So-and-so does his press-ups." And you see, it was turning the gang on. Oh, she was a character. So that's the character Therese. And Joe and I eventually had to set off for Perpignan. Arrangements were made. And we had a goodish trip to Perpignan on the train. And when we got to Perpignan station, the briefing was, we had the woman Françoise has appeared again with another man who went with Joe. And as we came out of the station, she said, "See that man with a paper." He had a newspaper like this under his chin. "Follow him. Don't shake hands. Goodbye." And that was that. Chap had his paper like this. So I followed him.
Vertical under the chin.
Joe didn't speak any French. And I followed him. We walked very slowly. He stopped and looked in shops, then went into a park. And in this park, we sat in a seat, and he said, "Which of you speaks French?" So I told him, and actually he spoke Catalan, which is a hell of a language. And he said, "Well, look, we've now got a long walk ahead of us, unless I can see what the buses are like, but I think we've got to walk, so I'll come here at 3:30. You hover around the park, don't go outside much, and then I'll pick you up and we'll set off unless I can pick up some form of tram." Well, he came back at 3:30, he said, "We've got to walk it." Now, the way it's done is this: my uncle will walk ahead of you, I will walk with you. He will have his Macintosh on his shoulder here.